Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. Fear and Trembling is a philosophical work, and it deals primarily with faith understood as trust and as passion, not simply as credence or belief. And in it, Kierkegaard is engaging in philosophy. So one of the key questions that is raised at one point in the preliminary expectoration section is, what can philosophy's orientation to faith be? What should it be? And by contrast, what should it not be, oftentimes being the case in his own time? So he tells us a few things here that we can piece together into a full-blown perspective on the relationship between philosophy and faith, but he doesn't go much further with this. And it's important to keep in mind that he is writing this, as he does so often in his works, under the guise of a pseudonym. In this case, it's Johannes de Silencio, who appears to himself be a philosopher, or at least somebody who has studied philosophy, is conversant with the philosophy of his time, and has some very definite opinions on that, as well as on faith and theology. And, you know, what we can say is that Kierkegaard is really going to give us two sets of ideas that he's proposing to us, proposing very strongly. One is criticism of contemporary philosophy of his own time, largely Hegelianism, but it could extend to many other ways of understanding philosophy as well. So he's criticizing the attitudes that many people in his own culture and intellectual milieu are setting out of the relationship between philosophy and faith. And then he's elaborating for us a different model, a model in which philosophy is remaining a bit more true to its own spirit and mission. So let's look at the criticism first. He tells us at a number of points in this work, not just in this section, but throughout the entire thing, that so many people in his culture want to begin with some sort of understanding of faith and then go beyond faith. And he also says they want to do this with the figure of Abraham. The idea is that, well, Abraham, he's got this relationship with God or the divine or whatever we want to call it, spirit. And it's very primitive. It's very crude. We don't want to be beholden to that. We want to take whatever is really essential, the lesson we can learn from it, and then get rid of all that other Stone Age garbage that is really just cluttering things up. And when we express it this way, I think you can see that there's not only a lot of people in Kierkegaard's own enlightened age who espoused viewpoints like that. There's many people in our own age as well who view religious faith or some of its key figures as these rudimentary starting points that have some lessons to teach us, but we need to really strip away all the dross and leave that stuff behind and then call out the few nuggets of, you know, whatever we want to call it, perennial philosophy, eternal wisdom, liberal ideas for the age, pick whatever tagline you like. And Kierkegaard thinks that that's a really fundamental mistake. Why would that be a mistake? Well, because faith is not something to begin with as a launching pad and then leave behind. It's actually something that is very difficult to attain and that you have to work towards and might be receding from you as you're moving towards it using the means of philosophy or whatever other intellectual apparatus you would prefer in that place. So having this attitude that faith is something to go beyond is going to be quite problematic. He's got a wonderful line in there about Abraham and about Hegelian philosophy. He says, it's supposed to be a difficult to understand Hegel but to understand Abraham is a small matter. Now, it is difficult to understand Hegel, in part because Hegel does not express himself well, but also because Hegel is working with quite complicated concepts, and there's this entire developmental view. That's quite true, right? But is Abraham dumber than Hegel? Is Abraham less expressive? Is there less to teach us? He says, to go beyond Hegel is a miraculous achievement, but to go beyond Abraham is the easiest of all. And he says, I, for my own part, have applied considerable time to understanding Hegelian philosophy. I believe I've understood it fairly well. I'm sufficiently brash to think when I cannot understand particular passages, despite all my pains, he himself may not have been entirely clear. This I do easily, naturally, without any mental strain. So he's saying, I understand the Hegelian philosophy. I may not be a preeminent scholar or practitioner of it, but I get it. Now, what about Abraham? He says, thinking about Abraham is an entirely different matter. I am shattered. I am constantly aware of the prodigious paradox that is the content of Abraham's life. I am constantly repelled. And despite all its passion, my thought cannot penetrate it, cannot get ahead by a hair's breadth. I stretch every muscle to get a perspective, and at the very same instant, I become paralyzed. Now, notice what Kierkegaard is not saying there. He's not saying, oh, well, you know, I didn't understand it the first time or the second time, so it must not be comprehensible, because if it's not understandable to me as the sort of representative of what really is, or the adjudicator of what really is understandable, then it must not be understandable in itself. He's saying, no, there is a paradox. There is something that resists my rational efforts to make sense of it before me. And I am trying my hardest to understand it. It's not a fault of the content the way it might be in Hegel, Hegel being unclear at points, being wrong at points. It's rather me, the rational agent trying to make sense of it, who may not be up to the task. So if that's the case, then we probably shouldn't try to leap beyond Abraham or faith in an instant. Another example of a criticism that he makes, philosophy, he says, disparages faith and gives something else in its place. He says philosophy should not do this. It's not really being faithful to its own goals, its own mission, if it's doing that. Why should philosophy not disparage faith? We have a lot of philosophical perspectives that do in fact disparage faith, and not in the sense of saying, I want to understand this faith. They say, listen, this is all garbage. These religious believers, they're deluded. They are mistaken. They are within the grips of their own desires and passions. They're projecting something out there that doesn't really exist. Kierkegaard doesn't go deeply into this question here about whether that's a legitimate position for philosophy that wants to remain true to itself as philosophy to take, but he does sort of set out his own view on this. Philosophy shouldn't be in the business of disparaging faith. Maybe faith isn't something that philosophy is really that competent, at least in certain respects, to say something about. He doesn't say that, by the way, that philosophy shouldn't disparage superstition or the co-option of religious beliefs by political systems or anything like that. As a matter of fact, later on in this, he will say that a church is really very much like a state. Both of them are to be distrusted. But he does think that philosophy shouldn't be in the business simply of disparaging faith, dismissing it. What else? Philosophy wants to give something in place of faith. Philosophy wants to say, here's what faith really is, or here's the nugget of truth in it. Here you go, religious believers. Have this instead. Wouldn't you be better off with this sort of thing than that crude, stupid, anthropomorphic thing that you believe in and practice? And Kierkegaard is saying that if philosophy wants to be honest, he says philosophy cannot and must not give faith, but it shouldn't give something else in its place. So then the question is, well, great, where are you supposed to get faith? And he is going to leave that unanswered at this point. Notice one other thing, too, before we go into what philosophy ought to be doing, about the conception of philosophy that he has here. And this is a conception of philosophy that cannot really be avoided, even by those who make an attempt to avoid it. Philosophy is one of those activities of the human mind that is totalizing. It attempts to make sense, in principle, out of everything. It attempts to extend itself to everything. It may not, in fact, be competent to do so. And we're not just talking about the competency of particular individual philosophers. We're talking about the competence, sort of in principle, of the entire discipline or activity. One of the key questions that is raised for philosophy, by philosophy itself, in relation to other disciplines, is can philosophy go over there into the domain of other disciplines and tell them what they ought to be doing, or make full judgments about what they're doing, or fully understand what they're up to? Or are there certain limits beyond which philosophy perhaps either shouldn't cross or shouldn't cross and expect its competence to be respected, shouldn't tell itself that it belongs there on that side of the limit? Many philosophers in the past and even in the present, even those who would like to limit philosophy's own pretensions in certain ways in a philosophical way, often do not respect that set of limits that are imposed by the other objects of human thought and activity. So he tells us that philosophy should do several things. One is just a little bit later, he's talking about the dialectic of faith. And he says, it's commonly supposed that what faith produces is no work of art. It is a coarse and boorish piece of work only for the most uncouth natures. Crude, right? And then he says, but it's far from being that. The dialectic of faith is the finest and most extraordinary of all. It has an elevation of which I can certainly form a conception, but no more than that. So notice that Kierkegaard here is not saying, faith over there, hands off philosophy. You've got no business whatsoever. He's saying philosophy can indeed form a conception of what faith is up to, but it can't do more than that. It doesn't understand it fully. It doesn't provide the blueprint for it. Faith, if it wants to teach philosophy, can teach philosophy something about itself and about its dialectic. So what should we do? We should form a conception of the dialectic of faith. We should, in fact, employ philosophy to do so. That is a legitimate use of that activity, that rational pursuit. What else? He goes on and he says that philosophy should indeed understand itself. This is in that passage that I'll now read. He says, I by no means conclude faith is something inferior, but rather that it's the highest and that it's dishonest of philosophy to give something else in its place and to disparage faith. We saw that just a little bit earlier. He says, philosophy cannot and must not give faith, but, here's a key but at this point, it must understand itself and know what it offers and take nothing away, least of all trick men out of something by pretending that it is nothing, that faith is nothing. Now, you might say, well, why does philosophy have to understand itself? This, again, is integral to the classic conception of philosophy. A philosophy that does not make an attempt to understand itself, its own activities, its own limitations, is not really much of a philosophy. It becomes something like an ideology, or like a set of algorithms, or like a set of instructions about how to do something that has no reflexive capacity. And that would invalidate it as philosophy, if you put it side by side with philosophy that actually does try to understand itself, that does attempt to make sense out of itself. That would be a significant problem, would it not? What else? He brings up this idea of faith, and he uses two different terms here, as being higher than and being beyond what it is that philosophy can do. So philosophy cannot dominate, analyze, put something in its place for faith, and it actually has to recognize that faith is, in a certain sense, greater than philosophy, and that is something that philosophy can, in fact, do. It will be very uncomfortable for most philosophers to do that, But that does not mean that philosophy cannot or should not do that. And if we follow Kierkegaard's conception that he's laying out here, what this means is that philosophy is always going to be in the position of a learner, or you might say a beginner when it comes to faith, rather than being the expert talking down to and giving rules to faith. And you might bring up one other question here, just to bring this to a close. Is this a reversion to what we might call the medieval understanding of philosophy as the handmaiden of theology? The answer is no, because Kierkegaard actually has a very dim view of the theology of his time. He says that love has its priests in the poets. Who speaks to the honor of the passion of faith? He says philosophy goes further. Theology sits rouged and powdered in the window and courts philosophy's favor, offers its charms to philosophy. He's saying essentially, sort of reversing Luther's dictum that reason is a whore, that theology is in fact acting like a prostitute and taking faith and putting it out in front of philosophy in order to sell it, which makes theology something pretty bad. So we don't have a simple subordination of philosophy to theology. Instead, we might say we have faith as a kind of limit beyond which philosophy is drawn, but also extends beyond its own competence. And it is philosophical for philosophy to recognize that. So that is one key idea governing this work, and hopefully that will help you understand the approach Kierkegaard is taking. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.